Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
H1N1, what you need to know and what you need to do. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Who's afraid of the flu? Asks one magazine headline. As the U.S. government prepares to hand out more than 250 million free doses of swine flu vaccine, health officials are confronting fear and misinformation. What is the H1N1 virus? Who should take a vaccine? By using early precautions to combat the flu, has the government caused more anxiety than necessary? On Reporter's Notebook, placebos are making people feel better, and pharmaceutical companies want to know why. First, the news. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Which Way LA on KCRW. We'll be talking about the H1N1 virus, swine flu, and how to make sense of media coverage and government precautions. What concerns do health officials have about the flu? What exactly is a pandemic? What can be done to prevent fearful overreaction? And what steps should you take to protect yourself? On Reporter's Notebook, startling news about the placebo effect, what scientists are learning about the body's ability to heal itself. First, this story. In New York today, a man suspected of plotting to set off a bomb near the anniversary of 9/11 has pleaded not guilty to a conspiracy indictment. Najibullah Zazi, an Afghan immigrant, was arrested last week in Denver on charges of lying to the FBI before being transferred to New York. Joining me is Tina Sussman, national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She's based in New York. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Were you in the courtroom today? Can you tell us what happened?
Yes, I was in the courtroom. It was actually a very short hearing, no more than about 6 or 7 minutes. And Najibullah Zazi came inside. He only said one or two words. His lawyer, J. Michael Dowling, did most of the speaking for him, including entering the not guilty plea. And there was no the prosecutors asked that he be held without bail. The defense did not object to that. Prosecutors said that he, in their words, poses a serious risk to the public if he were freed. They also say that he might flee if he were freed. And they also made clear, the prosecutors, that this is going to be a very long case. They used the term voluminous as regards to the evidence, and they said that the conspiracy, as they put it, is international in scope. So essentially that was a warning that this is going to be a very long trial once it does begin.
As you pointed out, today's hearing was a brief one, just a preliminary. Is there any sense of, you've pointed out the government expects it to be a long case, but do we know any details about the case that they've built and are building?
There have been bits and pieces that have been coming out. Most of the details came out, not actually in the indictment, but in another motion that was filed in Denver last week, which gave what prosecutors say is a broad outline of the conspiracy. Essentially what they're saying is that Zazi was using very common beauty products you can buy at any beauty supply store to try to find the perfect recipe, if you will, to build bombs or weapons of mass destruction, as they say in the indictment. And they say that they suspect he was planning an attack on or near the September 11th anniversary here in New York. They say that because, according to their surveillance of him, he became more and more agitated as the anniversary neared, and he still apparently had not come up with the proper way to make these explosives actually work. They also say that there are other people he was working with, however, they have not identified them, and they haven't arrested any others or charged any others in the case. That's something the defense attorney today was saying they will have to do quite quickly, because as he said, if you're going to have a conspiracy allegation hold up in court, you have to produce other people that the defendant was allegedly conspiring with, and so far they have not done that.
Are there any indications that there are links to Al-Qaeda in this case?
Well, the prosecutors say that there are links to Al-Qaeda. They say that this is based on Najibullah Zazi's trips to Peshawar, Pakistan, where they say that he actually took part in training at Al-Qaeda training camps, and they've called this the first, if not the most serious al-Qaeda-linked plot to be uncovered in the United States since the September 11th attacks.
The prosecution appears to be relying on evidence that they gained from FISA, from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Do you know anything more about that?
No, but they have said that they've made clear in court today and earlier that the bulk of their evidence is going to be material that they gained through that act.
And are there reports that his father was arrested as well?
His father was arrested, as was one other New York man, at the same time that Najibullah Zazi was first arrested, September 17th. But those two have not been charged with the conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction. They were merely charged with lying to federal agents investigating the alleged bomb plot, and both of them are now out on bail.
And why was the case moved from Denver, where Zazi had been living and where he was first charged, to New York?
Well, the indictment was handed down by the Eastern District Court here in New York. The allegation apparently is that the attacks were being plotted for the New York area, and so they moved the case here. There's also been rumors, nothing has been confirmed, that other people who are being investigated in the case are either from New York or in the New York area.
And what's the next phase, then, in Zazi's trial? When will he be in court again? He's been in Brooklyn federal court.
Well, he's not expected in court again until the beginning of December. And in the meantime, everybody's going to be waiting to see if any other arrests take place. The federal government has been saying for quite a while that they're looking at other people. And presumably before December, we'll find out who some of those other people are.
Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Tina Sussman is a national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She's based in New York. We'll be back in a moment with Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
I'm Sarah Terry, back with Which Way LA. By early next week, the first batch of some 250 million swine flu vaccine treatments will be available, free, paid for by the U.S. government. In an unprecedented preventive campaign, health officials are trying to blunt the impact of the H1N1 virus, or swine flu as it's commonly called. But symptoms are described as a mild flu. Is the public overreacting? Is the media getting the story right? What do you need to know? And what do you need to do? My first guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's chief of infectious diseases at Children's Medical Center in Dallas and a professor of pediatrics and microbiology at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Of course, you're in Texas. That was where the first cases were reported earlier this year. And you are seeing a new wave of cases now. Can you tell us what's happening?
That's right. Over the last 2.5 or 3 weeks, we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of children presenting to our emergency room with what we term influenza-like illness. That would be a fever and other symptoms of influenza infection. The number of patients that we're seeing in our emergency room is either, at some days, 2 or 3 times the number that we usually see at this time of year.
And are parents talking about why they're showing up? Are they afraid that it could be H1N1? Are they coming in with good information, or is this just preventive?
Well, it's a combination of all of those things. I should say that even though we've had this dramatic increase in the number of children presented to our emergency room, very few of these children have actually been admitted to the hospital. And that's not to trivialize the disease that these kids are experiencing. They look sick, but they're just not sick enough to be hospitalized. So in many cases, the parents are bringing the children in because they appear quite ill. They have high fevers. They have cough, congestion, other features of influenza infection. So certainly, I would say the majority of parents are bringing their children in for that reason. And, of course, there are some parents who are bringing their children in because of the concern of swine flu. They've heard that other children maybe at the school or sick with influenza. So there is some of that as well.
And how many of those children who've been coming to the hospital are being confirmed with the H1N1 virus?
So we've done selective screening. In other words, we're only testing those children who are high risk for influenza. And that's typically children who are either less than 2 years of age or children who have some underlying medical condition such as asthma. So in our selective screening, we've been testing them for influenza, and over the last several days, actually this has been true for most of the last 2.5 weeks or so, anywhere from a third to a half of those children are actually positive for influenza, and that's an astonishingly high number, particularly since we're using a test that's not all that sensitive to detect the novel H1N1. So a large percentage of these children who are presenting to Children's Medical Center who are being tested for influenza have H1N1.
But they're not necessarily being admitted to the hospital. How are you treating them?
So most of these kids are being treated symptomatically. In other words, if they don't fall to one of the risk factors and they don't have severe disease, then they'll be treated symptomatically with medicines to reduce their fevers and the typical hydration. For the children who do fall into one of the high-risk categories, or children who are ill-appearing, then we would treat them with antiviral medication, and the antiviral medication that we're using now is also Tamivir, or what's known as Tamiflu.
So with these parents who are coming in, the ones who are concerned, maybe they're worried about what's happening in their schools, what are you telling them?
Well, we're telling them that this influenza, H1N1 or the swine flu, appears to be very, very similar to the seasonal influenza viruses. The symptoms that we're seeing are essentially identical to seasonal influenza, and even the severity of the disease that we're seeing is essentially identical to seasonal influenza. So we give them advice about the warning signs for if the disease would to progress or if their child's case would deteriorate to bring them back. But essentially, we're giving the same advice that we would ordinarily give during the seasonal influenza epidemics.
As a medical professional, then, how would you characterize sort of this big ramp up to flu season this year, with the 250 million vaccines that the government is starting to provide, with the media coverage? Are we reacting out of proportion, or is there something here to be sensible about?
I think there's something to be sensible about here. Influenza viruses are predictably unpredictable, and we know this from past influenza pandemics. The virus that we're dealing with right now tends to cause mild disease, as I've already mentioned, but we're seeing it spread very rapidly through the community, and that's not surprising because there's very little immunity to this virus in the general population, so there's nothing to stop the virus from spreading rapidly. So I think we're being very cautious about it, and I think the implementation of a vaccine program, as you outlined, is warranted.
Will those vaccines, that's just the first batch that's coming out, I believe it's about 5 million that will be available next week, will they be coming to your hospital, or are they going to be coming to you in time to be useful?
Well, I think certainly if they're coming within the next couple of weeks, I think they'll be useful. I'm looking at the data right now, and we're still seeing very high numbers of children coming to our emergency room who have influenza-like illness, and a very high percentage of them, as I mentioned earlier, are testing positive. So we anticipate that we'll be getting some vaccine over the next couple of weeks, and I don't think it's too late to start vaccinating here or elsewhere.
And as a doctor, as somebody who's seeing these cases, I'm wondering if you could just step back a bit and put this in perspective for us. Do you have greater concerns than a normal flu season? Do you feel things are under control? Just give us some measured, response to what our take on the situation should be.
So this looks very much like every other influenza, seasonal influenza epidemic. What really stands out about what's going on right now is the time of year. So we've never seen this type of influenza activity in September. And we've never seen these numbers of influenza-positive individuals, children, this time of year. So that's one extraordinary thing about it. And in a sense, we're fortunate that this is not, at least at this point, overlapping with a seasonal epidemic, because if it were, then it would complicate matters as far as what type of antiviral therapy to give.
Because they're different treatments.
Exactly. They're different treatments. So we're fortunate in the sense that all the viruses that we're identifying now, for the most part, are the novel H1N1 or the swine flu. If we were to start seeing seasonal influenza, that would make things much more complicated.
We're talking to Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the chief of infectious diseases at Children's Medical Center in Dallas. Amanda Ripley is a contributor to Time magazine who wrote the article, Who's Afraid of the Flu? She's also the author of The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why? Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your article raises a lot of interesting points. Among them may be the how do we deal, that the biggest challenge of this could be how do we deal with the unknown. Could you explain that, talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, I think that this particular threat is kind of uniquely challenging for how the brain processes risk. So as Dr. Kun mentioned, influenza is sort of by design very uncertain, inconsistent, and unpredictable. That's how the virus operates. It changes. It finds your weak spots. It exploits them. And the brain really does not like uncertainty. So we know this from years of risk research, that the brain has a bias against uncertainty. So we're not great at sort of just dwelling with uncertainty and understanding that it's uncertain and trying to sort of stay informed and keep an eye on it and do what we can, but not, you know, sort of concluding permanently one way or the other that this is nothing to worry about or this is the end of the world. We're not great at sort of living in the middle space.
Well, how do we live in that middle space in this time between there have been, you know, reports of people who are indifferent to it, reports of people who are overreacting, or face masks showing up everywhere. How do we navigate that middle territory? Who gives the information? Who, you know, what can we do ourselves to navigate it?
Well, you know, I asked for the time story. I talked to a lot of experts in risk communication as well as epidemiologists and doctors of other kinds, and what they said that they do personally is to try to stay habitually informed by checking different kinds of sources. So you probably don't want to check, you know, the CDC's website and Health and Homeland Security's website. I mean, you know,
what do you mean?
The same thing.
Okay.
I mean, you want to check websites or, you know, publications or radio that don't always agree with one another, right? So you want to get information from different kinds of sources, mm-hmm. reliable sources, and the CDC is certainly a very reliable source, but it's not the only one. And so you sort of triangulate your way to kind of keeping tabs on what's happening without becoming overly dependent on one source that may or may not be giving you the full story. And another thing is, you know, anyone who understands how the brain processes risk knows that it is an emotional process, right? And emotions are really important, but too much emotion is counterproductive, right? And we know, for example, that certain kinds of sources are, you know, very emotional. And so, like, TV, for example, is a more emotional medium.
Like your 30-second clip, you know,
exactly,
swine
exactly.
flu cases, film at 11, and the just quick bites on it. Is that what you're...
Yeah, and also TV is a visual medium, and you can have a very vivid, unforgettable story about one person who dies from swine flu or H1N1, and that your brain it's just seared into your memory, especially if it's a child, and that may be useful, but probably it's not representative of the larger threat, right? So
because you're not getting the information on the rest of those cases of people who have a mild flu and don't die.
Right. Exactly, right.
Okay.
So it's your brain will prioritize the personal story like that, that's very vivid, over statistics.
Well, then I'm curious because the media can't be responsible for regulating one individual's response to the news that they see. But as a member of the media, how would you suggest that the media approach coverage of this flu season?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to acknowledge the uncertainty and just repeatedly try to explain that we are living with uncertainty and that that's okay, that we can't put it into one box, because that's what we want to do, right? We want to say, okay, this is just like the regular flu, which is a lot of people have concluded, or we want to say that this is the end of the world, which is what you hear from a small number of people and sometimes members of the media. Or I think a lot of people have sort of concluded that this is hype, this is media exaggeration, or even I've heard a lot of people talking about how this is the pharmaceutical industry's, you know, sort of incentivized to create fear. And so there's sort of these boxes we put it in based on our previous experience, and that's a very normal way to process the world. The problem is this particular threat jumps in and out of boxes depending on the day. So you have to keep reassessing where you've put that threat in your mind. That makes sense. And you're right, the media can't be entirely responsible for helping people navigate this, but it's certainly partly responsible. And I think actually, I mean, I cover disasters for Time, and I have to tell you, compared to the vast majority of potential catastrophes and actual catastrophes that I've written about,
the CDC and the public health institutions in America in general have handled this much more in a much more sophisticated and transparent fashion than other government agencies. So I think they have, in general, not in every case, worked very hard to remind people of the uncertainty, to try to dwell in that uncertain place, and to try to be very open about what we know and what we don't know. And, you know, they don't always succeed, but I have to say it's far above the average communication for a risk like this.
Can you tell us more about the use of the word pandemic? I believe that the World Health Organization actually changed its definition in recent years of what a pandemic is, sort of lowering the threshold. I mean, what's the word mean to us?
It's a great question, because as in most kinds of major public threats, it means one thing to the people in charge and a totally different thing to the public. And we ran into this problem when the World Health Organization, following its own public guidelines, determined that this was a pandemic earlier this year. And, you know, yet it hadn't killed that many people. So you ran headfirst into this collision between how they define a pandemic, which was, according to their guidance, almost entirely based on the geographic spread, not the severity of the threat.
But how many places it was showing up.
Exactly, yeah, and it was everywhere, right? So in that sense, it was a pandemic. But the public, of course, thinks of a pandemic as sort of an Armageddon-type situation where it's very severe and widespread. And so, you know, now if you ask them why they did that, it's not because they're, you know, totally clueless. It's because it's hard to rate the severity because it varies so much. I mean, it can be literally can devastate one town and then 15 miles away, nothing. So they punted, right? I mean, because it's hard to say how severe it is in a generalized way, they decided they wouldn't include that. And that's a very typical problem in whenever, you know, the people in charge try to label and categorize threats, which they need to do. You see it with hurricanes, you see it with all kinds of threats, where there's this sort of partial warning. It's sort of half of a warning. So you get a lot of confusion about, well, what is this and how worried should we be?
We're talking to Amanda Ripley, who's just written an article for Time magazine called Who's Afraid of the Flu? My next guest is Dr. George Benjamin. He's the executive director of the American Public Health Association, an advocacy group for public health care professionals based in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. I wonder if we can just step back for a moment, and we throw that word around, H1N1 and swine flu virus, but what exactly is it?
Well, let me start by saying that viruses are pathogens that one of their characteristics are that they cannot reproduce on their own. So the way they reproduce themselves is to infect the cells of other organisms, and that's kind of the fundamental characteristic of a virus. And when they infect those other organisms, they use the other organism's cellular machinery to, in effect, make copies of themselves. And influenza is a virus that does that. It's what we call a subtype A virus, and there are lots of types, so it doesn't really matter except the fact that these are organisms that, when they reproduce, they make millions and millions of copies of themselves. And they do that in such a way, sometimes they make great, perfect copies of themselves, but sometimes they make mistakes. In fact, they often make mistakes. And that leads to the unpredictability of them. So sometimes
making a mistake, meaning it isn't replicating itself exactly the way it was before?
That's correct. And when it changes, it makes sometimes it makes changes that makes it more virulent, so that it make people sick or more sick. And sometimes it reproduces itself in such a way that it just, you know, is not very virulent at all.
How does that relate to H1N1?
Well, it does, because one of the things that we know about this particular H1N1 virus is that it doesn't seem to have the particular piece on its genetic structure that we know is consistent with the viruses that are very bad, like the 1918-1919 virus.
Of course, that's the epidemic that, in fact, caused more deaths than World War I.
That's correct.
One is not, that doesn't have the component that made that one so severe.
Not yet.
Okay.
But one of the things that we know about these viruses, because of the way they reproduce, is that they can change very, very rapidly. And they can do a couple things. They can they basically, when they go into a cell, they exchange parts with one another. Sometimes they come out worse. Sometimes they come out more mild. And sometimes they pick up a dangerous piece of a genetic structure that makes them more virulent. And so if you get a combination of two characteristics, a virus that is easily spread from person to person, meaning the characteristics that it's acquired or developed allows it to be rapidly spread from person to person or from an animal to a person.
Swine flu?
Like swine flu, and I'll come back to that in a moment.
Uh-huh.
And it's very virulent, means it makes people very sick. And you get that combination together and in the right combination, then it can be a very deadly virus. Now, one of the things that we've discovered over the years is that actually in the beginning, most of these viruses came from birds. And then they infect people, and they also tend to infect pigs. And historically, the biological model that we've kind of had around influenza is that a human virus infects the pig, and a bird virus infects the pig. They go into that animal, they reassort, change parts, and then they go back out, and they can infect either a person or a pig. And the pig has always kind of been the model
the
which they reassort.
Why is the pig so vulnerable?
Because it's nature. It's just the way it is. And it just seems to work. It's served as a great melting pot.
Huh.
But what we discovered now, though, of course, is that that's not necessarily the case. And these things can jump species without that. We saw that with the Without going back to the pig.
Okay.
We saw that with the H5N1 virus. This was the bird flu. When we were seeing both it reproducing within birds, and it seemed to acquire ability, but not very effectively, to jump from birds directly to people without an intermediary. And so that was always the concern with that virus. This virus, of course, is classic influenza. It's out in the community. We don't know how it jumped to an individual. We do know that if you look inside the virus, that it has genetic structures that are ones that we identify commonly in people, one that identify commonly in birds, and one identified commonly in pigs. And so by that nature, it's a mixed virus. And again, somewhere along the way, this virus changed parts with other viruses and ended up with that combination. And because of that, it was so different that our bodies don't recognize it. They recognize it as a new virus, but it's very dissimilar to the influenza viruses we've seen in the past.
Okay, you've given a very thorough, although I know it's brief, breakdown there of a virus from a medical perspective. Step back now and tell me, speak to me as, Joe Public. What do I need to do? How do I approach this?
Well, just like you would with a cold, any kind of respiratory virus, the thing people can do to protect themselves, including washing their hands frequently, covering up their nose and mouth when they cough or sneeze, this is still predominantly probably a respiratory virus. In other words, you get it because people cough within your vicinity, usually 3 to 4 feet. You cough on a surface, someone touches the surface, and then they touch their nose or their mouth. You eat after one another. I mean, those are some of the kinds of things, someone who's infected, I might add, are the kinds of way we share viruses. And so clearly if someone is sick with influenza, you want to try to the extent you can, avoid one another and reduce your risk of both sharing that virus with others if you're sick and, of course, avoiding others who might be sick so that you don't catch it from them.
And can you tell me, why is flu a seasonal ailment? Why are we entering, flu season now as opposed to in June?
We don't know all the reasons why, but this virus in the past has been historically a cold weather disease. For some reason, this organism thrives in cooler weather. And so it's seasonal. So in our winter month in the northern hemisphere tends to be November through February, March, and the southern hemisphere then gets their winter opposite us when we're in summer. And what happens normally is this virus goes through the northern hemisphere in our winter and then through the southern hemisphere in their winter. And what we've done, we have this global system to actually track the virus. We know it's out there. And we have people, doctors, laboratories, and health facilities that actually are contracted with to track this virus, to do cultures, blood cultures, throat cultures, nasal swabs. And then those are sent to a laboratory. We process them. And we look and see where the virus is and how that virus genetically may change. And that's how one of the ways we know when a new virus is into the community and where it's going.
Let me ask you briefly before we bring another guest into the conversation, what kills it? If somebody has that flu and recovers from it, is the virus killed within them?
Well, your body has an immune response, and anytime you're exposed to a new organism, if you've seen that organism before, your body has a very rapid response to it. If you haven't seen that organism before, your body can still have a response, but sometimes it has to gin up a bit to actually respond to it. And that's what vaccines do. Vaccines fool your body into thinking that you've actually had the infection before so that you can have a very rapid response when you see that virus again.
We're talking to Dr. George Benjamin, Executive Director of the American Public Health Association. Serena Vintner is a Senior Research Associate at Trust for America's Health, a nonpartisan research and advocacy group in Washington, D.C. Thanks for waiting to join the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
What can you tell us about what federal and state governments have done to prepare for something like this invasion of a swine flu? We've mentioned that the federal government is making some 250 million vaccinations available, but what is being done systemically to prepare for this?
Well, I think it's important to look back a few years. Back in 2005, the federal government made a huge investment in pandemic preparedness. Now, at that point, they were more worried about the so-called bird flu that was circulating in Asia. But they put a lot of money into both the federal government in terms of stockpiling vaccines and stockpiling antivirals and creating vaccination capacity in the United States. They also pushed out $600 million to state and local health departments so they could prepare for pandemics. What we're seeing now, I mean, the great response that we've seen to date is really a testimony to that initial investment. More recently, with the H1N1, they've also dedicated a lot of money. I think that President Obama and the administration set aside something like $5.8 billion. Now, they haven't spent all that money, but they are pushing money out to the states. I think eventually, come October, $1.4 billion will go out to the states and local health departments, and that's to help them set up these mass vaccination campaigns and plan for the fall, sort of for the outbreak that we're seeing right now, to get state and local health departments up and ready for that.
Will this be one of the first tests of the effectiveness of the system that's been built up, as you've pointed out, since 2005? Will this be an opportunity to look at how effective the system is?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually the spring outbreak was the first test. And what we saw, I think, was pretty encouraging. I mean, there are definitely gaps and there are some big issues that need to be dealt with. But on the whole, I think we saw state and local health departments respond. They were creative in terms of working with hospitals and healthcare providers and setting up screening sites so that health departments' emergency rooms weren't overrun. Some hospitals are setting up sort of tents in the parking lot, so if you have flu-like symptoms, you go there first, and instead of coming into the emergency department and crowding that system. So we saw some creative responses, but I think you're right. It is a test of the system, and I think we're lucky we live in a country where we've done a lot to prepare, and fortunately we don't have mass casualty or mass public health emergencies on a routine basis, but we do have smaller ones, and so we've been ready.
You know, in the past, in when sort of crises have arisen, whether it's Katrina or as a natural disaster, we haven't always heard the best news about federal, state, and local authorities cooperating, working well together. What's the case in this situation?
Well, I mean, you know, the United States is a huge country, and so we are sort of by default going to have a system where there's a federal role, state role, and local role. And there definitely have been problems. I mean, I think the the past 8 years, the philosophy was that it was a shared responsibility, and the state health departments and the local health departments had a pretty big role to pull. And so you do see some gaps. I mean, especially when you look between states, between local health departments, there are some that are more prepared than others. But I just I do think that the federal government, by putting this money out right now, is trying to get all the state and local health departments up to speed. But I think that everybody realizes that there will be gaps.
We've heard from all of our guests, I think, a sense of, you know, that there's been some overreaction, or that there's a possibility to process the news in an overreactive or fearful way. We've also heard that some people are somewhat indifferent to it, or feel that that it's hype, or that the pharmaceutical companies have been pushing this as a way to make profits. What's the message that should be framed right now, do you think, and how would you put it?
Well, I think with emergency preparedness, and so it's not just for H1N1, but it's sort of any emergency, whether it's a natural disaster or terrorism. I mean, there is this sort of danger of complacency, that after the event, people get all wound up and sort of look at what went wrong and how they want to fix that for the next time. But then people sort of try to, you know, forget about it. And I think that's human nature. You don't want to dwell on sort of the negative, scary things. But as advocates for a strong public health system, I mean, I think what we like to remind people is that you can't be prepared for the H1N1s, for the Katrinas, if you don't constantly and sort of have a sustained commitment to funding public health. Public health isn't just to be there in an emergency. I mean, you want them there, but they're also there for day-to-day routine public health activities, whether it's food safety or controlling other infectious diseases like HIV/AIDS or doing chronic disease care. So if you're not funding your public health system to carry out these core activities, it's going to be hard to call on it when there is an emergency.
We've been unfolding the show today in sort of a guest-by-guest basis, wanting to have a thoughtful look at this issue of H1N1, the H1N1 virus and swine flu, as it's known. We've got time now on the show to let each guest sort of give us a final word, a word of caution, warning, advice, whatever they think is the thing that we most need to hear today. We'll go back to Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Children's Medical Center. Briefly, what is it that you would leave us with today in this conversation?
I agree with the previous comments that there's been a very impressive public response to this outbreak, this epidemic. And in fact, we're watching this in real time. We're collecting information on a daily basis, and we're actually looking at the genomic sequence of the viruses on an almost daily basis. So if the virus is going to begin to mutate, then we'll have a handle of that in a very short period of time. So I think the structure is in place right now to monitor this virus very closely and to monitor the pandemic very closely. And if, in fact, the virus does change, that information will be available shortly after it happens.
Thank you, Dr. Kahn. Amanda Ripley, you've written a recent article in Time magazine, Who's Afraid of the Flu? How would you like to sort of finish framing the conversation today?
Well, I think if the virus stays the same, then the real challenge ahead will be for people who are in the high-risk groups, right? And that's something that I think will become the real psychological challenge as well as medical, because what we know is that people in high-risk groups tend not to think of themselves that way. So I mean people who have asthma, people who have diabetes, heart disease, kidney disease, pregnant women. People don't, you know, identify themselves necessarily as solely a person with asthma, and they hear high-risk and they write it off and think that's not them. So it would be a mistake, though, for people to think that this is going to be mild for everyone. So this is what I mean about sort of holding multiple things in our heads at once. And I think this will be the really challenging thing, is that for lots and lots of people, the worst you're facing is just, you know, sort of a really bad week of feeling sick. And then for lots and lots of other people, as in millions of people, as in, you know, 30 to 40% of the country, the risk is higher, and it's important because those are the people who should most seriously consider getting the vaccine.
Thanks to Amanda Ripley. Dr. George Benjamin of the American Public Health Association, briefly, what are your final words today?
Well, I would encourage people to recognize that vaccination is the single most important preventive measure that we have against influenza, and I would encourage people to get vaccinated. Certainly those people in the high-risk groups are the ones that should get in the front of the line. But influenza comes every year, and this is not a one-year challenge, and they should plan for it every single year.
Thank you. Serena Vintner, back to you for the last word from the Trust for America's Health. How would you wrap up the talk today?
Well, I mean, I think our success or failure this fall is really going to be determined in part by how well our public health workforce is prepared. And unfortunately, although there have been some huge one-time investments, there's also been a steady decline overall in terms of funding public health departments. So I think these cuts in the workforce and cuts in core infrastructure are really going to have an impact, and I think we just have to sort of hope that this one-time infusion, this large infusion of cash, this Band-Aid is going to be enough to pull us through the fall season.
Thank you. Serena Vintner is a senior research associate with Trust for America's Health. Thanks to all of our guests, Dr. Jeffrey Kahn of the Children's Medical Center in Dallas, author Amanda Ripley, who's written the article Who's Afraid of the Flu in Time magazine, and Dr. George Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association. Placebos, or sugar pills, are going head-to-head with blockbuster drugs, and they're turning out better results. That's coming up on Reporter's Notebook. We'll be back in a minute with Which Way L.A.? I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. We're back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way L.A.? A funny thing keeps happening on the way to getting new drugs approved by the FDA. Placebos, or sugar pills, are beating out new medicines in test trials, causing a series of setbacks for big pharmaceuticals. Steve Silberman is a senior writer at Wired magazine. His article about placebos in the pharmaceutical industry appeared in Wired this month. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sarah. It's great to be here.
For those people who haven't seen your article, can you just give us sort of the basic findings that you're reporting on?
Sure. Well, basically, to get a drug approved by the FDA, you have to prove that it's more effective than a sugar pill or a placebo. So people who enroll in clinical trials as volunteers are randomized into two groups. One group will get the medication that you're testing. The other group will get pills that look exactly like the medication that you're testing, but that contain only an inert substance like milk sugar or lactose. And basically, that's because when people get drugs, even fake drugs, it triggers a healing network in the body that produces a cascade of chemicals that can actually do some healing work. It's not a miracle cure. It can do things like reducing inflammation or reducing pain. It can't do things like reducing the size of a tumor. So we're not talking about some miraculous mind-body healing network, but we're talking about a very specific set of physical reactions that occurs when someone believes that they're taking medicine.
This is kind of a surprise, isn't it, to the pharmaceuticals in some ways, to be really getting a better grip on this information?
Well, they've known about placebos for a long time because placebo control groups have been the basis for clinical trials since the 1950s, and in fact, that was a very good innovation in drug testing. However, what has been surprising them is that for some set of unknown reasons, the volunteers' response to placebos has been increasing worldwide, really for several years now, so much so that a big pharmaceutical company may spend hundreds of millions of dollars developing a new drug for, say, depression, and then have it suddenly fail in a stage two or stage three trial when you would expect that they already know how effective the drug is or not, particularly in a stage three trial. Suddenly the drug is not doing as well as sugar pills. And in fact, even more upsetting to the drug developers, some of the older drugs that are already on the market, like Prozac, are now failing against placebos in internal trials. So they are starting to look at all the data from clinical trials to try to figure out what's going on. And one of the things that I talk about in my article is not only the problem, but some of the things that might be happening.
I'm curious, what are some of the things that might be happening? Because that's startling, not just that it's beating in new drugs, but that it, in some cases placebos are now sort of performing better than long-known drugs such as Prozac.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things that many different things may be playing into this. One of them is that because of the success of antidepressants like Prozac, pharmaceutical companies have focused more and more on curing what are generally known as mood disorders like depression or social anxiety disorder or premenstrual dysphoria. And in fact, if they have a drug that is patented for one use, say depression, when that patent expires, they often try to repatent it for other kinds of disorders. And what's happening is that mood disorders in particular, as well as certain other disorders like Parkinson's disease and Crohn's disease, are also very amenable to the placebo effect. So basically, the pharmaceutical companies have focused in areas where the placebo effect is most intense. So in a sense, they're running up against the body's own ability to take care of certain disorders, at least in part. For instance, we know that antidepressants do help people, particularly with severe depression, but so can exercise or so can talk therapy. And in fact, if you test people with mild depression taking antidepressants versus people with mild depression getting more exercise, it generally works out to be about the same. But when people go to their doctor, they want to hear, here's the prescription that will help you. They don't want to hear, well, buddy, you have to hit the gym 3 times a week.
Well, let me ask you a question about that in terms of the implications. Have we become so medicalized as a society that we're just kind of going, oh, you're giving me a pill, I'm going to be better, so that it's triggering
a
response?
You know, yes. I mean, I think that is a very big question. I don't want to imply that I don't take mood disorders seriously. I have had friends who have been catastrophically depressed, whose lives have been completely turned around by antidepressants. I'm not saying that antidepressants are snake oil or fake drugs or anything like that. What I am saying, however, is that the problems that the pharmaceutical companies are now running into in proving that their drugs are better than sugar pills in trials indicates that they're working in an area where the brain has resources that we are barely beginning to discover. And we are now learning that we have more control over our own health than we previously believed.
And is this in parallel progress, do you think, to the interest in mind-body connections? Do they cross over?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that, there's one of the problems with talking about, say, alternative therapies like acupuncture and talking about the mind-body connection is that, like so many other subjects in the country right now, things are very polarized. So you have skeptics who are saying, stuff like acupuncture, it's just snake oil. It's just gullible people. It doesn't work at all. And then you have other people who are saying, that they had some kind of miraculous cure because of acupuncture. Well, what if, this is just a rhetorical question, what if therapies like acupuncture elicit the placebo effect? Normally, when people hear the word placebo, they think, oh, that means fake. But actually, this problem that the pharmaceutical companies are having show that the placebo effect is actually very real. And what if certain alternative therapies like acupuncture elicit a placebo response? Then that, in a sense, it doesn't matter whether or not there's such a thing as chi or acupressure points or et cetera. All that matters is that the patient honestly believes that they're going to be helped by this therapy. It turns out that, in fact, the brain has these networks of chemical reactions that can actually do some of that healing work just because the patient truly believes they're going to be helped.
And just briefly, are the pharmaceuticals going to be trying to figure out how to market placebos?
Well, in a sense, they already do. Think about it. Things like little purple pills that, help your acid reflux. The ads that we have been bombarded with for the last 10 or 15 years.
We've just got a little bit of time.
Television and magazines. They make you think that basically if you take this pill, you will be happy. And that may be one of the factors that is playing into these higher placebo responses in clinical trials.
Thanks so much for joining us today to talk about the placebo effect.
Thank you.
Steve Silberman is a senior writer for Wired Magazine. His article about the placebo effect can be found at his website, stevesilberman.com, or on our website, kcrw.com/whichwayLA. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Christian Bordahl with Katie Cooper and Gary Scott. Our managing producer is Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Wesley Roberts. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw/whichwayLA. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.